the Kennedy family may be the closest thing that we have in this country to a royal family. At its head was Joseph Kennedy, who grew up in East Boston before heading to Harvard, Wall Street, Hollywood, the Court of St. James, and ultimately sending three sons and a number of grandchildren to Washington. Now, through unprecedented access to the Kennedy papers at the Presidential Library, David Nassau has examined the life of Joseph Kennedy, and his book, The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy, was just named one of the 10 best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review. It's published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings David Nassau back to our show. Hello.
Delighted to be here.
Now, you were asked to write this book by Ambassador Jean Kennedy Smith and the late Senator Edward Kennedy. Did you jump at the chance?
No. I was in the middle of another book, and, you know, when I get in a project, I can't think about what's coming next. So I said, the Kennedys don't allow you to say no. So when I said, I'm not interested, they said, well, when can we talk? And we did talk about 6 months after that. And I said, my basic point was to Senator Kennedy, who I spoke with, you don't want me to do this book because I'm a crazy, obsessive researcher and I'm going to find something the family's not going to like.
And there already were a number of things well known about Joseph Kennedy.
Well, that's exactly what he said.
Would have been embarrassing.
Yeah, that's what Senator Kennedy said. He said, look, the bad stuff is all out there, but nobody knows the rest of the story.
So are you surprised that it's turned out to be pretty sympathetic?
I don't know. I don't know how sympathetic it is. It's hard for me. You know, you throw a book out there and it's 800 pages. And you don't really know what's in it until people start reading it and getting back to you. This is a complicated guy, and I'm very sympathetic to him as a New Dealer, and I absolutely adore him as a father. He's a remarkable father. But there's a lot there that, you know, doesn't make me happy.
Well, we'll get to a lot of it. There have been a number of other books about him and the Kennedys in general. Was the fact that you had access to these documents what made this different?
I think so. The other biographers had to really scramble to find material. Meanwhile, there was at the Kennedy Library 200 cartons of letters, diaries, financial records, medical reports. And they had been put away. Researchers were not allowed to see them. And all that was opened up for me.
And how much of it contained surprises?
A lot of it. I was able to see I'll give you one example. I was able to see his financial records and discover that one of the ways he made money in the 20s was through insider trading. And he had accounts at 10, 15 different brokerage houses under 20, 30 different names so that he could trade stocks that he was the CEO of the company.
Was he a pioneer in that regard? I assume other people were already doing something similar. Interesting that later he became the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Yeah. He was one of the best. He was one of the best insider traders. He was one of the best stock manipulators the country has ever seen.
Although he was an outsider growing up in East Boston, this isn't a rags-to-riches story, is it?
No. He came from a very comfortable family. The family business was politics. His father was the boss, the leader of the East Boston wing of the Democratic Party. And his father was also very successful in business. He was a banker. He had a real estate firm. He had some liquor stores. He did very well.
Was it preordained that he would be a Democrat? Because many people coming out of that kind of background will move to the other party.
There was no way he couldn't be a Democrat. His father-in-law was a Democrat. His father was a Democrat. And growing up in Boston, if you were Irish Catholic and you wanted to get anywhere in politics, you had to be a Democrat.
My guest is David Nassau, N-A-S-A-W. His latest book, The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy. It is published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You write about his incredible self-confidence. Where did that come from?
I think it came from early successes, and I think it came from being an insider in East Boston. He was one of the most respected families. He grew up in a part of the world where Irish Catholics were the business leaders, the political leaders, the teachers, the policemen. He grew up with everybody knowing him, and he had any number of early successes. And that gave him the confidence to believe he was invincible.
But he was, as you say, a Catholic. And wouldn't that have made it hard for him to break into Boston's financial sector?
One of the interesting things about this man was that it wasn't until he graduated from Harvard that he understood the world. Up until then, even though he was an Irish Catholic from East Boston, everything had broken his way. He'd gone to the best schools, had interesting friends, was a great sports star. Did okay at Harvard. Then he graduated.
He wasn't really an academic star.
No. But he was a school star. And he was an all-star first baseman, class president in high school, well-loved at Harvard. Then he graduates from Harvard, and boom, his world falls apart. He wants to go into banking or finance, can't get a job. The only way he can get into his chosen profession is to take a civil service exam and become an assistant state banking examiner.
Did he start learning how to push the legal boundaries of what he could do because he had that kind of job?
He knew exactly when it was the perfect training for him because he knew from the legal standpoint how to read bank books and to know what could be hidden, what couldn't be hidden, what was legal and what was not.
He'd been courting Rose Fitzgerald, the daughter of Boston's mayor, since high school. They were married just as World War I was breaking out in Europe. And did that set something of a tone for their marriage, that outside events would shape their lives in ways big and small?
They tried desperately in the beginning to make believe the world wasn't there for them, to make believe that World War I or the stock market boom or the depression wasn't going to influence them. But they quickly learned that was not the case. And it was Joe Kennedy, the patriarch's job, to, through good times and bad times, make a living for the rest of the family.
And the markets took a dive after the war began.
The markets took a crash, and Kennedy lost lots and lots of money for the first and last time in his life.
He was often outspoken against wars. Was it because of that, or were there other reasons?
There were a variety of reasons. As an Irish Catholic, he did not want, in World War I, American boys to go support the British Empire. He felt much the same way in World War II. But he also felt, as a businessman, that war was the worst thing for the American economy, and as a father, that war was going to sacrifice young men.
And that's exactly what happened his life.
Yeah, he opposed the war in every way he could. This is World War II. His boys, however, wanted to go off and fight. They did. One boy was killed when his bomber was incinerated right after D-Day, when the war was nearly won. His second boy, Jack Kennedy, was nearly killed and crippled, his father thought, for life as his PT boat commander. And the third boy, Bobby, was 16, 17 at the time, and he said, "I'm not going to college, Dad. I'm going into the Navy." And Kennedy accepted that and helped him find a way in.
As a married man with two children by the time the United States entered World War I, did he have an easier time getting an exemption for himself?
No. He had a rough time getting an exemption. It was a rough time getting an exemption in World War I because the exemptions had been so easily bought and sold during the Civil War, and people remembered that. In order to get an exemption, you had to be, if you were a father, you had to have no other means of supporting your family. He was rich enough that the family was going to be supported wherever he was. So he had to get a job that was necessary to the war effort, and he did as a shipbuilder.
You just go and you say, "I want to be a shipbuilder so I don't have to enter the military"?
No, you get there were a bunch of ball players. All the baseball players who didn't want to go fight went into the shipbuilding baseball leagues. Kennedy got a job as an assistant general manager of the Bethlehem shipbuilding unit at Four River. And he still had to fight. But he was indispensable. He was an extraordinary administrator and businessman.
How did he end up in Hollywood?
He ended up in Hollywood because, as an Irish Catholic, there was no other industry that he could establish dominance in, as that he could make deals with. The Boston Brahmins wanted nothing to do with moving pictures.
You say that his career as a bootlegger is a myth.
Yeah, I would have been delighted to write about Momo Giancana and bootleggers. But everywhere I looked, every story that was told had absolutely no basis in fact. I could not find, you know, you can't prove a negative, so I can't say absolutely he wasn't a bootlegger. I can say there is no evidence in any way, shape, or form that he was.
Now, you said he was a good administrator and businessman. And what did he do that was distinctive?
He was an extraordinary administrator in Washington. He created, really. He was the first chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission and then the Maritime Commission. And he put together from the ground up these huge and very important federal agencies. He hired everybody. He wrote the regulations. At the SEC, he accomplished so much in 15 months that when he left, he could no longer trade stocks because every trick and trade that he had used to make his millions, he had outlawed.
He insisted when he went to Hollywood on being paid in stock options. Now, that's not an uncommon thing today. Was he one of the first people to do that?
Yes, absolutely. He knew from the very beginning a dollar in salary is worth a dollar. $2 in a stock option, if you're as shrewd as he is worth $10.
Well, you have to have hits. And was he a hit maker?
No. Well, what he learned was that you don't have to have hits in that Hollywood. What you had to do was to drive the stock price up by promising you're going to have hits next year. And he did that very well with the help of some friends at the trade presses.
But how did he make the move to Hollywood?
He made the move to Hollywood. He bought a tiny little studio that was a British company that was deeply in debt. He also had a connection to his father's bank, a small bank in East Boston, that he used as his piggy bank. He borrowed money from that, bought stock in this company, enlisted others' friends in East Boston, bought the company for very little, moved to Hollywood, and then once in Hollywood, he convinced the studio owners that they needed an all-American Boston Harvard banker to front for them because the country was uncomfortable with an Eastern European Jewish-dominated entertainment complex. The fear was, and he was right, that all over the country there were censorship laws because people didn't want their kids exposed to Jewish branded and Jewish-made entertainment.
But Catholics were discriminated against at that time as well throughout the country.
When he went, this man knew ethnic politics brilliantly, and he knew the world was divided into ethnic tribes. So when he got to Harvard, he didn't talk about being a Catholic anymore. He talked about being a non-Jew, and that put him in the dominant grouping.
And he was outspoken as an anti-Semite. That was one of his more ugly sides. Was it simply because of his business background, or had he grown up in a family that also had anti-Semitic attitudes?
One of the things I discovered in doing this book was that anti-Semitism was a virulent disease. It was all over the country. It was very strong in Washington. It was very strong in Boston. It didn't matter where you were. There was this fear of Jews. 1,000 years of scapegoating Jews in Europe had come to the United States. And he not only did not escape that, he became a carrier of the myth of the Jewish conspiracy in very ugly ways.
He was a committed family man, but during his years in Hollywood, he spent a lot of time away from his family. Was that made a little easier because he had started an affair with Gloria Swanson?
He had an affair with Gloria Swanson that was just one of dozens and dozens and dozens of affairs.
Claire Booth Luce at one point.
Claire Booth Luce. We know about the Gloria Swanson one because Hollywood gossip columnists wrote about it, and then Gloria wrote about it in her memoir. But there were many, many other women. His deal with Rose was, I mean, never stated, never articulated, was that he wouldn't embarrass her and he would lead his own life.
So they had an understanding.
they had an understanding. He would allow her plausible deniability so that he would never put in her face his infidelities. And she could make believe and act as if he were a faithful husband.
And what was in it for her? I mean, many wives still would say, I can't live by that agreement.
60 years ago, many wives in the upper classes did live by that agreement. Rose's father and mother had lived by an agreement just like that. So it was much more natural to her than it is to us today.
And do you think that's something that was passed on to the sons? Because all of the Kennedy men were alleged to have been unfaithful to their wives.
I think so. I think that Kennedy set the example, and certainly Jack followed it.
My guest is David Nassau, who is the author of a number of important books, biographies of various powerful Americans. The most recent, the one we're discussing, just was named one of the 10 best books of the year by the New York Times. It's The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy, published by the Penguin Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with David Nassau, NASAW. His latest book, The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy, published by the Penguin Press. As a father, Joe Kennedy has been described in many different ways. What kind of a picture did you see of him as a family man?
I found him to be an absolutely remarkable father, a less than stellar husband, but a astounding father and grandfather. When I first met the children, the living children, they all told me these stories, and it was clear just from talking to them that this was authentic love, admiration, and respect for this man. And then
what did he do?
He raised each of his children to be independent, confident, strong, to have a point of view, and to go into public service. He said over and over to them, I've made all this money, so you don't have to make any money. And it's your responsibility. And some of this may have come from his Catholic upbringing. As privileged, wealthy children, it's your responsibility to do something for those who don't have your privileges.
Well, doesn't that make the story of the botched lobotomy of his daughter Rosemary all the more surprising?
It's a frightening, horrible story. And I found, because I was looking at, I saw records and letters to doctors that nobody else had seen. This is a marathon. From her birth, they knew that Rosemary was, quote, slow was the word they used. Later they used retarded. They tried everything. They tried herbal treatments. They tried thyroid treatments. They tried the best doctors, priests, schools, tutors in the land and in England, and nothing worked. By the time Rosemary was 20, she was angry. She had a temper. She was violent. As long as she had lived within the bosom of the family, everything was fine because the kids were wonderful to her. Joe Jr. and Jack would take her to dances. The younger girls would take her shopping and traveling. Now at age 20, she was left alone. And Joe was told, the patriarch was told by the best doctors in the land that while a lobotomy was not going to cure her retardation, it would make her accept it. She wouldn't be anxious. She wouldn't be depressed. She wouldn't be unhappy. The founder of the procedure won a Nobel Prize. The lobotomy was performed by the head of neurology at Johns Hopkins University Press and a Yale Medical School graduate. It went terribly, terribly wrong. She came out of it with the intelligence of a baby, of a child, unable to speak, unable to take care of herself.
But then he cut off communication with Rosemary after she was moved to Wisconsin in 1948. Doesn't seem like a loving father.
But what's remarkable is from the time the lobotomy takes place in the early 40s through 1948, he watches over her. He moves her from institution to institution, visits her, talks to the doctors. Rose does not. What I find remarkable is when Rose writes letters to the kids, she would always go through so-and-so is here, so-and-so is there. Rosemary drops out of those letters as if she's dead. Kennedy continues to visit her. He finally finds a place for her in Jefferson, Wisconsin, at a convent school and home. And from that moment, ceases all communication with her. He never sees her again for the rest of his life. The family, when they begin to see her, they only do it after he's had his stroke and because he doesn't know about these communications.
Was Joe Kennedy a committed New Dealer?
Yes and no. He was committed to Roosevelt. He was committed to the Roosevelt who he thought was the conservative who was going to save capitalism and therefore save democracy. He was more to the business side of the New Deal. And he thought that Roosevelt was too many times too harsh on business and had too many crazy left-wing advisors.
Well, how did the Depression affect him as a man who lived by his investments?
He understood the way Wall Street worked. He understood that the market was oversold. He understood that hucksters like him had destroyed the faith in the market. So he got out before the crash. He then, after the crash, got back in because though Herbert Hoover was telling the nation, don't worry, things are going to be fine, Kennedy knew they weren't. So he got back in the market, but now only sold short, only bet on stocks going down, and made several millions more.
When FDR appointed him to be the first head of the Securities and Exchange Commission in 1934, it was widely criticized because of his background as a banker and a speculator. How did Kennedy win over the critics?
He won over the critics by doing an absolutely remarkable job. He understood that unless the bankers and the traders and the markets were reformed, capitalism would lose, the American people would lose faith in capitalism and would be tempted to look more favorably on an American-born Mussolini or Hitler. And there were plenty of them around. So capitalism had to be saved, but the only way to save it was to regulate it.
And then in 1938, he was named ambassador to the court of St. James. That seems like a step down in many ways. And why would he give up a job that he was doing so well to become the only Irish Catholic appointed to the job, a man who was hostile, as you said earlier, to the British?
Yeah. He wanted to go because, one, he was the first Irish Catholic. Two, as an outsider who wanted to be inside, this was the job that you look at the roster of ambassadors. There are five presidents. There are Adamses, Lowellses, Lawrences, all the blue bloods. This is what he wanted. He also wanted to raise his kids, have his kids spend 2 years in London, and he wanted his children to be able to say, as they grew up, my father was the ambassador to Great Britain.
But his tenure there was kind of troubled, wasn't it?
It was miserable. He was the world's worst ambassador. He refused to follow orders, refused to engage in any kind of diplomatic protocol, set his own agenda. And his own agenda was that anything is better than war. Therefore, any deal with Hitler is better than going to war with Hitler.
Well, there were people in Britain who took the same position. Sir Oswald Mosley wasn't alone. So on the other hand, was he angering the British government?
He went way beyond the British.
Neville Chamberlain did appease Hitler, didn't
right.
he?
Right. Neville Chamberlain appeased Hitler, was the architect of Munich. But by 1939, Neville Chamberlain had given up on Hitler. Neville Chamberlain understood that there was no making a deal, that this was a madman who had no principles. Kennedy kept trying to make a deal and moved against Chamberlain, tried to make a deal with Hitler. He met with one of the remarkable letters I found was a letter from Chaim Weizmann, the future president of Israel, who had met with Kennedy. And Kennedy said to Weizmann, I'm going to try to get myself invited to Berlin to meet with Hitler and to save the European Jewry and to make sure there's a peace settlement that will forestall any war.
So why did Kennedy develop a reputation for being a sympathizer with Hitler? Says something similar to Lindbergh.
Yeah, it's wrong. He was not Lindbergh. Lindbergh truly believed that a Hitler-dominated Europe would be better for everybody. Kennedy believed that there was no way to stop a Hitler He didn't like it, but there was no way to stop it. And if the West went to war with Hitler, the West would be destroyed. Better to reach an agreement.
Why was the British Foreign Office spying on Kennedy while he was serving as our ambassador?
After Kennedy, after Neville Chamberlain and Halifax and all the other Brits realized that war was in the offing, that no deal could be made with Hitler, Kennedy kept trying to make a deal, number one. Number two, whenever he had the chance, Kennedy would say to the British people, the British politicians, the British newspapers, make a deal with Hitler because Hitler's going to destroy you in war if war ever comes.
Because he saw the German military as being much stronger?
Because Lindbergh was a friend, and Lindbergh advised him that the German Air Force was and the army was much better. Remember, this is before Hitler makes the mistake of turning towards the Soviets. So Hitler can put the entire power of his military to conquer Great Britain. And Kennedy was convinced that Great Britain couldn't win.
For someone who'd grown up around politics his entire life and could work a room as well as he did, he could be incredibly impolitic. Was he better working behind the scenes than standing in the spotlight?
Yeah, he was much better behind the scenes. He very much disliked what had happened to Irish Catholic politics and politicians. He didn't want to be a clown like he thought his father-in-law was. He didn't want to sing Sweet Adelaide. He wanted to be behind the scenes, and he was brilliant at it.
And he expected his kids to do well. Joe Jr., of course, that ended when Joe died in action. But then he set his sights on building a political dynasty anyway. Was Jack a natural to be groomed to run?
He never thought Jack would make it in politics because Jack was too skinny, Jack was too shy, and Jack was too sick. Nobody believed when Jack got back from war service that he would live to be 30. But Jack had a stamina that even his father didn't understand. And Jack became one of the secrets of Jack Kennedy is that he out campaigns everybody he ever runs against and has more money than anybody he ever runs against.
Now, the kids both seem to have adopted some of their father's beliefs, but also reject a fair amount. And with somebody like Bobby, he moves from working for Senator McCarthy, something I assume Joe would have approved of, to being seen as the great liberal hope.
Yeah.
So what happened? Their father was opposed to the Marshall Plan. I can't imagine that either Jack or Bobby were opposed to the Marshall Plan.
No. Their father was an extremist. He knew he was an extremist. He came back from World War II with this dreadful reputation. He was a pariah, a Cassandra, and he figured he would make the most of that. And he became an extreme isolationist. His children had to back away from that, because they didn't believe it, number one. And number two, they'd never get elected dog catcher if they talked like their father did.
Now, you've written about Andrew Carnegie, William Randolph Hearst. Both men had plenty of enemies. Now, Joseph Kennedy. Do you think all of these powerful men have been misunderstood or poorly remembered by history?
Yes. I think we know. We have textbook cartoon character-ish views of the great men of our past. They're quickly categorized as heroes or villains. History is much more complicated. Human nature is much more complicated than that.
And the end of his life almost seems like something out of Shakespeare. He has a debilitating stroke 11 months into his son's presidency and then lives another 8 years watching two of his sons assassinated. He outlived four of his nine children.
It's a dreadful, dreadful, dreadful story. After his stroke, he can only say the word no. And the people in the room with him have to figure out what he means by looking at his eyes and the tone in which he says his no. He loses all power of communications, much like his lobotomized daughter.
So his sons could not really go to him for any advice?
Not after his stroke in 1961. And yet they visit him. They love him. They're there all the time. Bobby and Jack are continually flying from Washington to Hyannisport or to Palm Beach to be with their father for the weekend.
Do you think there are many more misunderstood important figures in American history?
I think so.
Your career is not ending?
It is on hiatus for the moment, but not ending, I hope.
And nobody's pressuring you to do something?
There's a little pressure here and there, but I'm going to sit tight for a little while at least.
Meanwhile, David Nessa will be giving a talk tomorrow at noon at the 92nd Street Y Tribeca at 200 Hudson Street. When you talk to people about Joe Kennedy, are you surprised by all of the stories that you consider to be myths, like the bootlegger story or like the fact that he was an admirer of Hitler?
Yeah, everybody's got a story. And I spent 6 years tracking down every one of these stories, and they all fall apart in the end. I would say, where did you hear that? Well, my uncle told me. Can I talk to your uncle? Sure. And I'd talk to the uncle, and the uncle would give three other people down the road from whom he had heard this story.
Well, the bootlegger story, almost everybody's heard. Did he ever sell whiskey at all?
He gave whiskey in 1922 to his Harvard reunion. That was it.
The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy is David Nassau's latest biography. It is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's been a pleasure.